This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Stephen Himesfield, the Executive Director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. He has some health findings, including some myths about obesity. We'll talk with Stephen Himesfield. Also, the blogger from Bayou Buzz, Stephen Sabludowski, on the trials and tribulations of Governor Bobby Jindal as we approach the start of the April 8th legislative session. Does the governor have the legislative clout to get two-thirds support in the House and the Senate for his tax plan? And what's going on with this Medicaid contract that has now been revoked after it was announced there was a grand jury investigation going on in federal court in Baton Rouge? And Amy Stewart, the author of The Drunken Botanist, Tying Booze and Botany Together. First, the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Hope you had a great weekend. Glad you're starting your week with WRKF. And in studio is Dr. Stephen Himesfield, the Executive Director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, and the father of Chesley Himesfield, who was on this show not so long ago, talking about the International Film Festival. The Himesfields are taking control in Baton Rouge.
They are. Thanks, Jim.
Well, you have unearthed yet another major study from the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, which is on the cutting edge of findings about health in our world. And this one is about myths regarding obesity. What are some of the most common ones?
Some of the most common ones, perhaps the most common one, is that if you make a very small change in the number of calories you eat every day, that over time you'll lose a very large amount of weight. Like if you just drop that one M&M a day, that over a year that you'll lose.
That's a lot of M&Ms.
It's a lot of M&Ms. But the myth...
But that doesn't help you?
Well, you will lose a little amount of weight, but not nearly as much as people think they will. And that myth has been around for more than 50 years.
Well, if people don't drop an M&M or two or three, then they might start eating more. So some might say there's some validity to that so-called myth.
That's true. You definitely don't want to gain weight, particularly if you're already overweight. You don't want to move into that obese range. That would be mm-hmm. very dangerous. And it's true that if mm-hmm. you do watch what you eat, you will prevent that. But the idea that you can lose a very large amount of weight by simply reducing your intake by a small amount is incorrect.
But it's an incremental thing for many people. You take a fit man like you, what, about 170 pounds?
Yes, maybe even a little less than that, hopefully.
Okay, well, if you gain a pound a year and you live another 30 years, then you're at 200 pounds and you're a heavy man.
That's correct. So the idea is you definitely want to prevent that long-term weight gain, because that eventually will push you up into a high-risk zone.
Okay, here's myth number two. Setting realistic goals for weight loss is important because otherwise patients will become frustrated and lose less weight. That's a myth?
That's a myth. That idea was around for quite a while, that if you set a clear goal for your weight loss, that'll help you eventually get there. In fact, most people who even begin a weight loss program have a goal to begin with. And so setting that goal isn't critical as much as it is keeping on your plan and losing that weight over time.
Okay. Large, rapid weight loss is associated with poor long-term weight loss outcomes as compared with slow, gradual loss.
That idea is a very interesting one. It came from this era of very low-calorie diets, liquid protein diets. I don't know if you remember that. People who lost a tremendous amount of weight very quickly rebounded and eventually came back to their starting weights again. That idea actually led to this idea that if you lose too much weight quickly, it's a bad thing. But in fact, it doesn't really matter. Long-term weight loss can be achieved either by slow, gradual weight loss or even large, early weight loss.
Popular media and scientific journals contain numerous false and scientifically unsupported beliefs about obesity, according to a new study published in the latest edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. Pennington Biomedical Research Center Executive Director Stephen Himesfield was part of an international team of researchers that analyzed articles published in the scientific and popular press coverage to separate myths from evidence-supported facts. How many people were on this research team?
Actually, it's a remarkably large international team. There were about 20 people who contributed to this all over the world. And that's how we came up with so many different ideas, myths, presumptions also, things that are presumed true but not really tested, and facts.
Okay. 297-5633 is your number. As you know, this ideal protein is the rage of the day. We had sugar busters about a decade ago. These diets come and go, but it's worked for a lot of people. I see a lot of people, friends of mine, who are much slimmer now than they used to be. Is that something that can sustain itself, or is it likely that these folks will blimp back up?
Well, it's very likely that in the long term, people will regain the weight. It's very hard to maintain long-term weight loss, particularly if you're on a very restricted kind of a diet. So having a balanced diet, something that's healthy, is the most appropriate thing over the long term.
Okay. Last time I was on this show, or you were on this show with me, however we want to put it, you told me I needed to drop a few pounds, and I've dropped a few. I've gone from 207 to 203. My goal is to get to 195. I'm doing it incrementally. I'm doing the one less M&M a day philosophy. Am I doing it the right way?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. In fact, keeping that weight off is the most important thing. And even a 5% weight loss can make a big difference. So in your case, 10 or 15 pounds have a major
12 pounds.
Health benefit.
But this is in contrast to a recent study from you saying that being mildly overweight is actually a good thing. So are we getting contradictory messages from the Pennington Center?
Actually, that study came from the Center for Disease Control, but I wrote the editorial that went with it. And in that study, interestingly enough, the scientists found that being overweight actually conveyed some beneficial effects on longevity, but a very controversial study, something scientists are still trying to understand.
297-5633 or 877-217-5757 for Dr. Stephen Himesfield, the Executive Director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, one of the world's most prominent health gathering organizations as far as fact-finding, and it's located right here in our community. Charles in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Charles. You're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve. I wondered if you could discuss the effect of viruses on obesity and the research that Pennington is doing on that. And it's a wonderful research facility and great staff you have over there.
Thank you, Charles. That's a very interesting question. One of our scientists, Dr. Nikhil Durander, discovered a number of years ago that if you induce viral infections, particularly in animals, you can cause obesity in those animals. And that also has some relationship to human obesity. But the most important part of Dr. Durander's discovery is that he found that a certain protein in the virus can have beneficial effects on diabetes risk, and he's pursuing that, looking for drugs that potentially can reduce the risk of developing diabetes. So this viral research really had many wonderful outcomes related to it.
This epidemic of type 2 diabetes that we have in the United States and in Louisiana, is that something new?
Well, diabetes has been around for a long time, particularly type 1 diabetes, of course. But type 2 diabetes, the adult onset variety, is exploding in prevalence. Louisiana is among the highest in the country. More than 10 or 12% of Louisiana residents have adult onset diabetes. And the numbers are growing, even in children. And the reason it's growing is because it's being pushed by the obesity epidemic. More than 80% of people with adult onset or type 2 diabetes are obese.
And that is something that is getting worse in our country. As we noted 50 years ago, people of normal weight today or considered normal would be considered overweight. So we're smoking less as a people, but we're eating more, and obesity is just as dangerous as smoking, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's certainly seen that way by many people. There's a strong analogy between the two. But smoking is certainly the number one health risk. If you smoke to the extent you can stop is very important, or prevent smoking. And many people see reversing the obesity epidemic like reversing the smoking epidemic. More than half of Americans mm-hmm. smoked in the 1960s. Today it's down to in the 20% range.
Yeah, you said more than half.
Yes.
Of Americans smoked 50 years ago.
Yes, adults.
Okay. And yet we were slimmer then as a people. So is there a correlation between smoking and girth?
There is. People who smoke tend to weigh a little less, and there are some scientific reasons for that. Smoking reduces your appetite and increases your metabolic rate a little bit. And when you stop smoking, there is weight gain. And unfortunately, many people smoke to keep their weight down, particularly young women, which is a very dangerous thing to do.
So if you're saying, if it comes down to eating a little more a day or smoking a pack or two of cigarettes, I'm getting the impression you're saying eating a little more is much better.
I would say that letting your weight go up a few pounds would be worth stopping smoking.
There are people who do both, who eat a lot and smoke a lot.
That's right. Now, that puts you into a very dangerous territory for your health.
297-5633. Here is myth number four from Dr. Himesfield. It is important to assess the stage of change or diet readiness in order to help patients who request weight loss treatment.
The reason that came about is because this idea that you shouldn't really treat patients who are obese unless they're ready to be treated. And there's actually a test called the readiness test. And that became very popularized. Then there was a strong belief in its validity that if you weren't ready, you weren't going to lose weight. But in fact, most people who begin a weight loss program are ready, and the readiness testing doesn't really discriminate between those who do and don't lose weight over the long term.
Okay, myth number five. Physical education classes in their current form play an important role in reducing or preventing childhood obesity.
Yes, I think this one is perhaps one of the most controversial in that we've reduced physical education classes in schools, as we all know, and that has been tied to weight gain in children and lack of fitness. And the idea then is to put these classes mm-hmm. back in place and promote weight loss. But in fact, it's healthy for children to have physical activity, but it does not significantly promote weight loss.
877-217-5757. That's the number that Chuck in Lafayette has dialed. Chuck, you're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment that, you know, the nature of research is to limit the variables that the researchers are looking at, and that it gets very complex for the average person to try to interpret that research in a meaningful way, like the, you know, losing a lot of weight at once versus over a period of time. You have a confounding variable of the, you know, the psychological commitment to a long-term change. And I just think that if we had more researchers actually interpreting information in meaningful ways to the folks out there that are using it, it would help a bit.
I appreciate that comment. It's very important for the scientists and the press as well to communicate the research accurately. So often findings that are very early or out of context get promoted very widely in the press and often distorted. So I think it's responsible for scientists to get out there and explain their results to the public.
We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Himesfield. He is the man who runs the show at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, and he is once again on the cutting edge of some new findings about health and about obesity. And you'll be surprised when we return after this brief time out about myths number six and number seven. These are the showstoppers from Dr. Stephen Himesfield, who is smiling with earnest and relish as we prepare to talk about myths number six and specifically number seven. You want to hear all about seven. 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Kevin Gallagher's producing, and we'll be back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number for Dr. Stephen Himesfield, the executive director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. He's been there for 2.5 years, been here for 2.5 years, educated in New York State. So Louisiana is somewhat different in any number of ways. In New York, they have a $4 a pack of cigarette tax. In Louisiana, it's about 36 cents.
That's correct.
So we also like to drink a lot in Louisiana. What about alcohol consumption? What does that do as far as maintaining weight?
Well, alcohol, of course, has calories in it, and that can promote weight gain. And there's a beneficial effect of small effects of alcohol. It's a little controversial, but excessive amounts of alcohol, of course, not only promote weight gain, but can provoke liver disease and addiction.
Mm-hmm. Do you drink at all?
I do. I'm a social drinker. I drink periodically, and I don't go beyond the limit of one or two drinks a day, of course. That is recommended.
Joe in Lafayette. Joe, you're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Thanks. My question is, I've always heard a calorie is a calorie, that it doesn't matter so much what you eat as how much you eat. And then there's also the conflicting information that you get good carbs versus bad carbs, increase your protein. So is that true? Is a calorie a calorie? Does it matter if you eat 1,000 calories worth of Twinkies versus 1,000 calories worth of veggies?
Well, a calorie is a calorie to the body, but calories can have different effects. So, for example, if you just drink something that has a lot of sugar, you will get less satiation and less fullness than you would if you drank, say, something that was a complete meal, like a milk product. So equal number of calories from milk, equal number of calories from soda. Those calories will be interpreted differently by your body.
297-5633. I read something in the science section of the New York Times a few weeks ago saying that if you consume meals after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you're less likely to gain weight. That sounds like one of those myths.
That absolutely is a myth, that the time of day makes a difference. So this has been studied many, many different ways, and it is really the number of calories you eat over the 24-hour period that makes a big difference.
Robert in Prairieville. Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Okay. I just was wondering, no one ever mentions about all these preservatives and additives that are in food now, and things like aspartame. Aspartame's not good, but yet it's approved by the FDA. I mean, what about all the preservatives now that are in food that weren't in food in the 60s?
What about preservatives?
Well, our food definitely has been transformed. In many ways, it's a miracle that we have the amount of food and the quality of food we have. But nevertheless, the kinds of preservatives and other ingredients in food are first tested in animals over the short term, and of course they wouldn't put anything into us that has obvious dangers in animals. But in many ways, the long-term effects of these things have to be monitored, and we have to find out whether or not there are risks. And often it takes many years to do that.
Carol in Sherwood. Hi, Carol. You're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Good morning. I would like to ask the good doctor about the effects of MSG, the flavor enhancer, and what he thinks about that. I'm allergic to it, so I don't eat out a lot. I do my own food. I'm also a diabetic. I've been diabetic for 25 years, but I weigh within 5 pounds of what I did when I graduated high school. And I'm wondering how much this flavor enhancer has to do.
Well, flavor enhancers like MSG, some people are, in fact, very sensitive to them, and that is a problem. And you have to avoid foods like Chinese foods, of course, have a lot of MSG in them as a source of flavoring. But also diabetes can have a very strong family history, and weight doesn't always play a role. And there are people who, in fact, are quite normal weight, particularly as they get older, who do develop diabetes, the typical adult-onset diabetes.
The glucose reading that you get when you take one of these blood tests, some doctors say 100's an acceptable level. Others say 90 is the one that is the true acceptable
yes,
level. Which one's more?
That's correct. Generally, under 100 is important to maintain that in the fasting blood sugar or blood glucose. And these ranges vary over time. But once you get above 100, even higher, particularly with a glucose tolerance test, then your risk of diabetes can be increased substantially.
What do you do to get that number down?
The best thing you do to get that number down is lose weight, keep that weight off, mm-hmm. and watch what you eat. Avoid high carbohydrate diets and other things that promote high blood sugar.
The carbohydrates are converted into sugar.
Carbohydrates are sugar,
right, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, well, yeah, there's no conversion. It is what it is.
Yes.
But what about alcohol? That's the same thing, isn't it?
Well, alcohol is not a carbohydrate.
But the result is the same.
The result is the same.
All right. 297-5633, James in South Downs. James, you're on with Dr. Stephen Himesfield.
Yes, I had two quick questions. I find that proteins sustain me, so meat and nuts and things of that nature, can I overeat them? Can I exceed a quantity there? And also, on alcohol, is there a difference between the alcohol in wines and in other types of beverages? I'll take your answer off the air.
Well, eating nuts and other types of fruits and vegetables can have beneficial effects. Nuts often have monounsaturated fats, which are not necessarily unhealthy. But, of course, you don't want to eat so many that you gain weight and have problems from that.
Myth number 6 of the 7 from Dr. Himesfield, breastfeeding is protective against obesity. I've always heard this. Is that not right?
Well, breastfeeding, of course, has many beneficial effects that we're well aware of. But as a way of preventing obesity in children, it has been shown not to be effective.
What about weight gain involving the mother?
Well, weight gain involving the mother is a significant problem, something we're studying at Pennington right now. Many women following pregnancy gain weight and continue to gain weight and become obese, and that is something that can be helped perhaps by breastfeeding and also watching what you eat as well.
All right. 297-5633. In just a bit, Stephen Sabludowski, the noted blogger with Bayou Buzz, but a few more minutes with Dr. Stephen Himesfield, the executive director of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. Claire in Oak Hills. Claire, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Himesfield.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Dr. Himesfield. I just want to say I had an opportunity to work with Tess Lee some years ago when she first moved here, and she's very talented. But my question to you this morning is, I am involved with the Providence Corporate Cup race, 5K race, and it's all about corporate wellness. We have a future CEO obstacle challenge, and so every year I've been reading your report on children's, the report card on children's health. And my question is, why do we remain the same? The scores are very low in almost all categories, and for the last 6 years that I've looked at it, they don't seem to change. I may be wrong about that, but can you tell me what has to happen for those results to change? Thank you.
Well, we'll have to have children become more active. We'll have to get their weights down into a range that's more acceptable. And that process could take a very long time. In fact, we seem to be stabilizing somewhat. It's not clear, but it looks like the country as a whole, including Louisiana, is stabilizing somewhat weights in children, but this is a slow process. It took 50 years to reverse smoking, and we're still not all the way there. I think this is going to take a long time for us to move the needle.
Thank you, Claire. And here is myth number 7. One episode of sex burns 100 to 300 calories for each participant. That's a myth?
That is a myth. That's wishful thinking. Perhaps there's some kind of marathon sex I'm not aware of, but nevertheless, the real number is about 20 calories for a typical sex.
20 calories, and I'm not being whimsical, but that's on how many minutes of activity?
6 minutes is the average, and one can frame that in terms of your own thinking, but that is what scientists have found.
So it's 20 calories for 6 minutes?
That's correct.
So if it was 60 minutes, it'd be 200 calories, right?
That's right.
Well, maybe in some cases you do burn 100 to 300 calories.
Yes, that would be extraordinary exception to the rule.
Well, thank you, Dr. Himesfield. Always a pleasure.
Yes.
And good to see you smile, and let's talk again soon. What's next? What are you working on right now?
Well, we're trying to improve the overall delivery of healthcare in the state. We're working with state agencies to improve clinical outcomes by looking very carefully at the data that we've collected from state institutions and helping to reduce costs and improve healthcare delivery.
Well, let's talk again soon.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim.
Glad you're in Louisiana, too. 2.5 years. He stayed the course and looks like he's ready to keep on rolling. With us now is Stephen Sabludowski, the noted blogger. His website is bayoubuzz.com. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Jim.
And Stephen,
how are you?
I'm doing well, and I would consider you a journalist and a lawyer. And Bayou Buzz has been around now for how long?
I think about 14 years, roughly 14 years. It's a long time when you consider, you know, new publications getting online and, you know, some media outlets actually at that time didn't have websites.
14 years ago, around 1999 in the 20th century, Stephen Sabludowski started Bayou Buzz, one of the first. I think I remember you and John Cope starting at about the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I think Cope's maybe preceded me, and his the Duck Box, I think it was.
Yep.
It was really terrific.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stephen's writing is always on the mark regarding what's happening, and here's a recent example. In the last few days, you write, for almost 2 years, members of the media and others have been complaining about a rather unhealthy Medicaid contract with the state. However, from the Jindal administration, we heard nothing. So only hours after, and only after the Advocate broke a story reporting that the contract was under federal investigation, did the administration take action. They canceled the contract. What do you make of this?
Well, it just certainly doesn't look good. I mean, I don't think anybody can say that it looks good. I mean, there's so many issues, so many questions that you know, I think can be asked, and so much information that really needs to be divulged. And I'm afraid we're not going to get that information anytime soon. So it just looks bad overall. In fact, I would say it looks horrible overall. Especially with Governor Jindal going into a legislative session in which he's got a very unpopular tax legislation that needs a supermajority. And his credibility is on the line. And so if his credibility is on the line on a lot of different things, particularly this particular contract, then why would legislators and others, you know, have faith in what he's saying? And right now, you read the media, they don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, the newspapers in the state, almost en masse, have denounced the sales tax swap. And as you state, the governor, he has to get this through the legislature, and he needs more than a majority. He needs a supermajority of 2/3 in the House and the Senate, 70 votes in the House, 26 votes in the Senate. It would appear that there's a lot of noise in the background, and this Medicaid development is just one more thing. How can he do it?
Yeah, I don't know. And then, like, for example, today he's going to be speaking at a Chamber of Commerce event on the North Shore, north of Lake Pontchartrain. And, you know, when he normally would do that, you know, he would field questions from the media afterwards. And I really wonder whether, you know, how is this going to deal with this particular issue? Are questions going to be asked? Is he going to dodge the questions like he dodged the issue regarding the Bayou Corn sinkhole? You know, it just doesn't look good.
297-5633 for blogger and lawyer Stephen Sabludowski, Bayou Buzz is his site. 14 years he's been covering Louisiana politics, and that goes back, of course, to the administration of Mike Foster when Bobby Jindal was a member of that administration. Jeff asks about the fate of Bruce Greenstein, the health secretary. Is he in any jeopardy as a result of this Medicaid fiasco?
I would think so. I mean, as a publisher of Bayou Buzz, as an attorney, I mean, I certainly would think he's in trouble. I mean, he's in the center of this. I mean, number one, he says that there was, you know, some kind of firewall between he and CNSI, and then only after talking about an hour after he said that, he reveals that the contract had already been let, and CNSI was already the winner of the contract. And so you have to wonder, okay, well, he said he did communicate with CNSI. He also said that he communicated with the other vendors. So the question becomes, well, okay, you know, what was said? And were there any documents, you know, that corroborated? Were there any documents between, say, his office and the division administration, the governor's office, et cetera? These are all issues. These are all issues. And one of the things I just read, I got to tell you, and I don't know all the ramifications of it, but as I understand, the big Medicaid issue relative to Obamacare and the contracts that are related, you know, to how we're going to make up the $800 million shortfall are, you know, centered around Bruce Greenstein. And so, you know, his credibility is questioned. And so, there, you know, it's not just this contract, CNSI, which is, what, between $240 and $300 million.
Well, and
depends upon, you know, what you're looking at.
It's the been estimated picture by some to be $340 million.
Yeah, I don't, you know, it depends on, you know, from what I could see, it was $180 plus $10 and then another $40 million. I mean, that's the way I looked at it. So roughly $230 million, and which was real close to the contract that was already in existence, or the bid of the contractor in existence.
297-5633. Stephen Sabludowski, the publisher of Bayou Buzz, is with us, and we'll talk more about the Jindal administration and the tax plan. The legislative session opens 2 weeks from today, and we will find out soon whether the governor goes forward with his tax plan. It sure looks like he's planning on doing that, but right now there's a lot of criticism from the print side of the media, and we'll talk with Stephen Sabludowski about whether any of this ink matters as far as framing the issue with the people at large and getting legislative support. Back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. And with us to talk some more is Stephen Sabludowski, publisher and attorney, and the man who's put out Bayou Buzz for 14 years. We're discussing the media frenzy that has enveloped regarding the governor's tax plan. Almost every newspaper of consequence in the state, when I say consequence, that's an overstatement, probably. The big newspapers in the major metropolitan areas, they've come out against this plan. Here's an example in the Picayune Sunday. James Gill's column has a headline, Jindal's Plan, a Tax Swap Only the Rich Could Love. Do these editorials really matter, Stephen Sabludowski?
I personally think they matter. Now, one could say look to the fiscal reform legislation that Buddy Romer had has supported way back when he was governor, and the media supported that. But there was a big difference, I think, and that is that at the same time there was a conflict going on with Buddy Romer and David Duke, and Duke went around the state, and he was very popular at the time, and he went around the state denouncing the plan. So here you have the media who's looked at this, and Parr, who's looked at this plan. General's plan, and they're raising questions about it. And the only person going around the state right now is Jindal promoting it. And there's, you do have on the other side others who are going around the state, like the ministers last week. And so, but regardless, how is it going to get the things passed with the supermajority? I mean, remember, he also was promoting the consolidation of the universities. I think it was SUNO and UNO, and then he dropped that the first week of the session, and that was an important thing for him at the time. So this, likewise, is very, I mean, this is critical for him, and I just don't see it. I don't see it.
All right. Well, it's getting brutal out there. The Gridiron Show was hard-hitting involving the governor.
What was it? Yeah, I missed it. Yeah, I was wondering. Was there anything, if you can divulge, was there anything regarding CNSI?
I think that came a little late in the game. They probably had the scripts already written. But in one skit, Smiley Anders playing Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, devours Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, eats him alive, literally. And Jindal's final parting was, And that was pretty cruel. This is the governor sitting right there in the front row. And Jay Darden, Saturday night, the lieutenant governor, he took the gloves off against the governor and had some fun at Bobby Jindal's expense. And as we know, Bobby Jindal's name comes from Bobby Brady in the Brady Bunch. Lieutenant Governor Darden said that if the governor had been a fan of MASH, his name would have been Hawkeye Jindal. And he said that if the governor had watched Sanford and Son as a kid, he might have been Lamont Jindal. So, Bobby Jindal, at least he shows up. Buddy Romer quit going to the Gridiron shows when the heat got intense, but he's still going. You're a New Orleanian. You've lived there how long, Stephen?
All my life. New Orleans, Metairie, but within Metairie within New Orleans area.
Well, you and the rest of the state, but particularly the New Orleans area, lost a legend in broadcasting. I think he died Thursday night, Alec Gifford. He was a television presence in New Orleans from 1955 to 2006, and we're talking main anchor positions, 51 years on the air. Went to high school with Buddy Diliberto and Peter Finney at Jesuit High School. He was an icon like few others in the Crescent City. Alec Gifford. And Stephen, I went to school with his son, Russell, who once was watching his dad on television as a young man, and his dad came home and he said, "Dad, are you Alec Gifford?"
Are you the same Alec Gifford? That's right. I guess if Bobby Jindal was down here in New Orleans watching Alec Gifford, his name would be Alec.
That would be appropriate, considering that legislative group that's ALEC.
That's right, ALEC. Yeah, that would be appropriate.
It could be Alec Jindal. That would work.
That'd be perfect.
Or Alec Baldwin, Alec Jindal, and Alec. And
that'd be perfect.
What's this about Toujak's closing? Is that true? The restaurant that opened in 1856 on Decatur Street?
That's I read about that last week. It was just an excerpt I saw, and I do know that the owner of Toujak's had died recently, and I to be honest with you, I don't know whether or not there's any relationship between the death of Steve Latter and Toujak's.
Well, let's hope it stays open. The restaurant.
Yeah, maybe John George's will buy it.
Well, he's buying everything else. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's funny because I really, believe it or not, I thought about a year and a half ago that he was interested in buying the Advocate. I had a conversation with him when he decided, it was after he decided not to run for governor, and there was just some things he said back then that indicated to me that he had his eye on the Advocate. So I was not surprised at all. I was not surprised.
Amy Stewart, the author of The Drunken Botanist, is coming in a few minutes, but I want to slide in one caller that Kevin has told me that we got to go to. It's Doug Baker from Tim Barfield's office, the man who runs the Department of Revenue. Good morning, Doug. I'm sure you have the tax plan on your mind. Good to hear from you.
Well, Jim, thanks for taking the call. We always appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners, and Stephen's perspective is always helpful and welcome. And we appreciate the opportunity to at least say hello to you this morning and to talk with you, or at least to answer any questions we have that might be available about the tax plan. Let me first say that there has been a lot of discussion about this because it's so very important to the citizens of the state of Louisiana. And we understand the scope of it, and certainly the governor understands the scope and the magnitude of such a plan that would basically put every income group in a better situation than they are now, to take money away from special interest and into the pockets of citizens. And I think Tim has certainly been out there talking about this for quite a while, as has the governor, to make sure that as best as we can in the complicated tax code that we have currently, that it is stable as much as we can possibly put it on stable footing. It is, as far as we can, neutral. It is more transparent. I mean, the exemptions are 468 in number. It's just difficult in conversations that I've had with reporters in trying to outline what will be kept, what will go away. I mean, the Constitution of the state of Louisiana reads like a chicken soup for the political soul.
All right. But, Doug, I'm telling you, we're a little short on time, but I will make this offer if you're okay with it. If you or a representative from the Department of Revenue would like to come on the program at the start of the show tomorrow, where I can give you more time to express your point of view, I would really like that. I'm sure our listeners would. So if you can do it tomorrow at top of the show, let's make a date.
Well, Jim, thanks for that, and thanks to Stephen as well, and we look forward to updating you further.
Okay, let's see if we can make it happen tomorrow. Thank you.
Alrighty.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And, Stephen, let's talk to you as we go along. This is going to be an interesting year.
Yeah. It was supposed to, I mean, even before all of this, it was supposed to be, at least the people I've talked to, called the legislative session from hell. And, you know, now I think it's hell and high water. Honestly, Troy, I appreciate what the gentleman said, and I thank him for the very kind remarks, and I know his work is cut out for him. And Tim Barfield is a very a decent person, and I think that his work is cut out. I just don't see it. I do not see it. I don't know one person who really supports it. Now, I personally am open to, I have not taken a position against it.
All right. Well, Stephen, we thank you, and let's talk soon, and hopefully we'll get Doug, or maybe we'll even get Tim Barfield back, but we'd like that to come tomorrow. So thank you very much. And joining us now is Amy Stewart, the award-winning author of 6 books on the perils and pleasures of the natural world. She is the co-founder of the popular blog Garden Rant and is contributing editor at Fine Gardening Magazine. Her latest work, which has been featured in a few other venues on National Public Radio, is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
Well, we know about a few of these plants, but you go into depth and places I was unaware of. What were some of the nuggets of information that you have unearthed that are most entertaining and interesting?
Well, I really went plant by plant. So there's a chapter on sugarcane, and there's a chapter on grapes and agave that makes tequila. But there are a lot of very strange plants around the world that get made into alcohol. The cashew tree actually produces a fruit, not just a nut. And people in India make a high-proof spirit called Feni out of cashew apples, which is definitely an acquired taste. I've had it.
Well, you were on Morning Edition not so long ago, and you said a trip led you to the writing of The Drunken Botanist. What kind of trip was this?
Well, I just happened to be out of town. I happened to be up in Portland with a friend of mine who's also a plant expert and a landscape designer, and we sort of got into an argument over a bottle of gin. He said, I don't really like gin. I don't really understand the appeal. And I said, you know, there's nothing but distilled plant matter in this bottle. A bottle of gin is nothing but a bunch of plants that have been essentially liquefied. How is that not interesting? And pretty soon I was going on about how interesting it is that really everything behind the bar is a plant. It's just plants in bottles.
Well, The Drunken Botanist is organized by ingredients with entries for plants both common, beer and barley and beer, vodka and whiskey, and the unusual. And that's where we get into Amy's intrepid reporting. You argue that some odd-sounding plants are actually surprisingly common, like sorghum.
Yeah, I think sorghum is fascinating. You know, throughout Africa, it's grown because it's very drought-tolerant and can really get through famines. But huge numbers of people in Africa make homemade beer from sorghum. And all throughout China, they make a high-proof spirit called Maotai out of sorghum. Even in the U.S., sweet sorghum can be pressed like sugar cane and made into rum.
What do you recommend for some amateur mixologists?
Well, you know, I always recommend growing what works in your climate, first of all. Don't fight it too much. So, you know, if I lived in a tropical climate where it was warm all the time, I'd be wanting to grow tropical fruit. I might be interested in pomegranate. There's all kinds of unusual citrus you can grow. I live in the Pacific Northwest, so for me it's more things like berries and things that can tolerate the cold a little better.
Well, Amy Stewart, in her book, The Drunken Botanist, explores a dizzying array of herbs, flowers, trees, fruits, and fungi that humans have, through the inspiration, sheer desperation, and ingenuity, contrived to transform alcohol over the centuries. Sake, for example, that began with what, rice?
Sure, yeah, nothing but rice. Rice in a very strange mold called koji mold that has been cultivated for centuries and centuries to help ferment it.
Scotch?
Well, scotch is barley. Used to be made with a lot of other things. Used to be they'd put corn in there or wheat or whatever they had, but these days it's barley.
How about tequila?
Well, that's agave, which is a very strange succulent plant in Mexico that's used to make not just agave, but pulque, which is kind of like beer, and mezcal, all of those.
Bourbon?
Well, bourbon has to be at least 51% corn in order for you to be able to call it bourbon. But most bourbon's more like 60, 70% corn with a little barley and then either some rye or wheat thrown in.
And rum?
Rum is sugar cane, and in fact, people try to make rum out of other sources of sugar, but by law, you can't call it rum unless it's actually this giant overgrown grass that we know as sugar cane.
What are some of the most dangerous elixirs?
Well, you know, it is interesting. There are some potentially poisonous plants that get used to make alcohol. One that some people might have heard of is wormwood, which is Artemisia absinthum. It's a silvery Mediterranean herb with a bitter flavor, and it contains a compound that could cause seizures at very high dosages, but the honest truth is that not that much of it ends up in the bottle if you make absinthe or some of the other things that are used that use wormwood. It's not really going to hurt you at the levels that it's present in a drink.
Well, it's a book that not only tells us where our drinks emanate, but also tells us how to make them if you so desire. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, you know, I'm really a Manhattan drinker. I drink, you know, whiskey is sort of my drink of choice. And there's also a lot of really good vermouths out on the market. So the nice thing about Manhattan is you can put in a very high-quality vermouth that's actually pretty drinkable on its own, but lovely in a cocktail.
Are there any drinks that are more healthy than others?
I wish. No, you know, the fact is that a lot of cocktails use plants that are potentially medicinal or even just good for you because they contain a lot of vitamin C, but you would get alcohol poisoning before you ever drank enough of it to get the health benefits. So I'm afraid it doesn't work that way.
Well, I'm sure you're elated, Amy, at the attention your book is getting.
Yeah, it's been fun. I'm out on the road. I'm going to be on book tour for the rest of my life, I think, certainly through the rest of the spring, all over the country.
And some exceptional reviews. The San Francisco Chronicle says Stewart's fascination with her subject is infectious. The Dallas Morning News says Amy Stewart understands that a good book can be about a subject as commonplace as the ground beneath our feet if the author has a passion to share it. Thank you so much, Amy Stewart. It is The Drunken Botanist, a spirited toast to the marriage of botany and booze.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's going to do it for today. We thank you for joining us, and congratulations to the LSU Lady Tiger basketballers who have advanced to the second round of the NCAA tournament with a victory over Green Bay last night. And we will follow them, and of course we'll follow the governor's tax plan, and we've issued an invitation to the Department of Revenue, and hopefully we'll have a guest tomorrow to start our show to resume discussion about the governor's tax swap, which is, as you can imagine, gaining attention all over the state. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.